News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, coming to you each and every Sunday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and KMJ580.com. Thanks for listening to the Bulldog basketball game. Sorry to make you wait for our weekly visit with World War II veterans. Remember, if you have a veteran that you'd like to tell me about, you can email me, paul at KMJ580.com. Also on our website, you can find past editions of the program, so feel free to check that out at KMJ580.com. Hope you had a great Thanksgiving. By now, you should have digested the turkey and survived all those effects of tryptophan, and hopefully you're wide awake to listen to our visit today with a Navy veteran of World War II. Jim Robison makes his home in Selma now. Jim, let's start where I like to start with most of my guests. You're born in February 1922, so you were about 19 years old on December 7th, 1941. What do you remember about that day? When did you find out and how about the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor?
It was a Sunday.
Right.
And I was in church.
Mm-hmm.
And it was made note. The announcement was made from the pulpit of the church.
Wow!
That the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor, and everybody says, "Where is Pearl Harbor?" At that time, it was a remote spot.
Mm-hmm. So, did the significance, the magnitude of that, strike you right away, or did it take a while?
Yes. Well, it was a surprise. The Japanese would attack an American base, but the full implications we didn't realize.
And this was down in Southern California? That's
yes,
where you were?
Yes, in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Did you realize right away that this was going to change your life, that you'd be called upon?
Not really.
What were you doing at the time? You're done with high school.
I was working for Security Pacific Bank.
Mm-hmm.
In downtown Los Angeles.
How long was it until the Navy got a hold of you?
Probably almost a year.
Were you drafted or did you sign up?
I enlisted. I tried to enlist, and my eyes weren't perfect, so they wouldn't take me. And I went around to the different branches of the armed services, and finally they lowered their requirements enough to where I could make the Navy.
What was your first guess? And let me guess. Did you want to be a pilot?
No.
Okay. A lot of guys say they wanted to be a pilot.
No, I knew my eyes would restrict me from that.
Uh-huh.
I was restricted from aviation and submarine duty.
But the Navy took you.
Navy took me.
And you thought bell bottoms might look okay on you.
Yeah.
The ladies love the bell bottoms.
That's right.
What was that like getting into the Navy? Was it what you expected? Was it a little tougher? Was there a welcome to the Navy moment that you experienced?
Well, we were scheduled to go to San Diego, and when we arrived at the train station in Los Angeles, the chief petty officer in charge of the group said, due to the exigencies of the war, this group has been reassigned to Great Lakes, Illinois. Come back at 3 o'clock sober.
They had to throw that last word.
That was my induction to the Navy.
Well, San Diego and Great Lakes, Illinois, that's a pretty big discrepancy weather-wise.
That's right.
So that's where they sent you?
Right.
What happened next?
Well, after boot camp in Great Lakes, and they rushed a boot camp through, it was used to be a longer period of time, but they shortened it because they needed them in so rapidly.
So you were spared a little of that misery?
Yes. Then they sent us in after we graduated from boot camp to, I came to San Francisco, what they call receiving station, to be assigned further assignment.
Did you have an idea of what kinds of things you were hoping to do?
I want to go on a ship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Navy, see the sea, see the world. They called off the names alphabetically, and they stopped two names in front of me with a guy named Robinson, because I'm Robinson.
Mm-hmm.
And that group went to ADAC, Alaska.
Mm.
And then the group they called where I was the head of the list went to South Pacific, so I was real thankful for that.
Well, I hope they didn't get any of your clothes mixed up, because I know a few guys that got sent to the Aleutians and they didn't have the right clothes. But you got to go to the warmer weather.
That's right.
In the South Pacific. How early on in the war was this that you were deployed?
This was in August of 1942.
So pretty early.
Yes.
Things were just getting going.
Yeah.
That's a pretty long ride across the Pacific.
21 days, because we had to run a zigzag course because of the Japanese submarines.
Mm-hmm.
So it took a lot longer to get across than it normally would.
And what kind of ship were you on?
A Dutch merchant ship. Mm-hmm. The MS motor ship Sommelsdijk.
That's a mouthful.
And they were all they did was transport troops for the United States.
Was that a fairly uneventful trip for you? Was it kind of nerve-wracking? What was that like?
Well,
you're still a pretty young guy here.
Yeah, it was fairly routine until we had a fellow die of meningitis aboard. And you're sleeping five high in bunks, and so they were quite concerned, and we started taking all kind of medicines and so forth, so to stop, but to keep it from having an outbreak of it.
So 21 days later, you arrive where?
I arrived in Noumea, New Caledonia.
Mm-hmm.
And because we were flying a quarantine flag because of the meningitis, they wouldn't let us in harbor. We had to go around on the backside of the island for 30 days quarantine.
Well, that must have been fun.
Oh, yeah, just sitting aboard ship.
What do you do? How do you pass the time?
Well, I passed the time because I was just a young seaman, about the lowest rank you can have, and I rode on a motor whale boat taking people back and forth to the shore from the ship.
Well, at least you're seeing something
besides
your room that way.
No.
So then what? At some point, I imagine, you finally got a little bit of that sense of adventure that you were probably hoping for when you signed up for the Navy.
Yes, our orders were that we were to, our final destination would be Island X, and that's all they would tell us.
Mm-hmm. And so they pulled out the map and X marked the spot? Is that how it worked?
And so from Noumea, New Caledonia, they sent us all to Guadalcanal to away transportation to our island, which was about maybe 50 miles east of Guadalcanal.
So this was still before the big battle at Guadalcanal?
No, it had taken place.
The first one had taken place.
There was still a sniper action, but the main battle was already over.
Did that give you a taste of what war was going to be like?
Yes.
Did you see some of the aftermath?
Yes, it did.
What kinds of things did you see? What struck you?
Well, we saw where the Japanese had bombed a American hospital tent with a big red cross on top of it. And that kind of infuriated everybody and invigorated them to get out there and do something about it.
As if you didn't have enough motivation already.
That's right, yeah, yeah.
And what kinds of duties were you assigned?
I was what the Navy called a gunner's mate, and that is keeping the guns in firing order.
Mm-hmm.
And you might say a mechanic on the guns.
So is that a pretty busy job, or are you kind of sitting around waiting
for something to go wrong? Pretty all day long.
Mm-hmm.
It's a full eight-hour day.
Running back from one gun to the next?
Well, and just keeping them going, because you had an officer who would come by and inspect them to make sure they were all in firing condition. And
they always were with you on the task, right?
They had to be.
What happened to you if they weren't?
Well, you'd have problems.
Would you be on KP, something along those lines?
Maybe so.
Uh-huh. I imagine by this time, you've been in the Navy for a while, probably a few lighthearted moments that had come up already. Were there some things that...
Yes, when I went over from Guadalcanal to Bonica in the second wave of groups that went over, and my buddy had gone in the first one. When I got over there, he was wearing a helmet. And I thought, oh, boy, they've had action. So I said, what's with the helmet? He said, oh, no. He was walking along and a coconut fell and hit him on the head. And so ever since then, he's been wearing a helmet.
You never know what kind of dangers you might face. And Bonica, that you just mentioned, that's in the Solomon Islands, and I understand it was home to a big coconut plantation?
It was a palm olive peat coconut plant. The island I was on was a coconut plantation. And just everywhere you looked was rows of coconut trees.
So I guess if you were low on rations, you ate coconut.
Well, we drank the coconut milk and ate the coconut.
You still like coconut?
Still love them.
You got you hooked, huh?
Yeah, well.
And by this time, had you been shifted to an airplane tender? What kind of ship were you on at this point?
My 22 months in the South Pacific, half of that was on the island, the other half was aboard ship. So I spent probably 10 or 11 months on the island.
All right.
And then they disbanded the unit, and my next assignment was a seaplane tender, the USS Wright.
Now, I imagine that the island was a little different than living in Los Angeles.
3 miles long and six miles long and 3 miles wide.
And what about inhabitants?
None. They had moved them all to the island of Puvuvu in the Russells.
So you guys had it pretty much to yourselves.
Right. Marines and the Navy and later the Army came.
And I'm sure you never got into any trouble.
Oh. my buddy and I had a chance to open a laundry in addition to our gunnery work.
Mm-hmm.
We had three washing machines, and we took in washing and made extra money.
Ever play any pranks on any of your fellow sailors?
No, but I had a yes and no. The Marines came wanted to know if we'd wash their clothes for them, and we said yes, but it'll cost you so much. So they left their clothes there, and one day we took a load out of the washing machine of white underclothes, skivvies they called them.
Mm-hmm.
They were pink. A guy had put a baseball cap in, and we hadn't seen it. And everything turned pink. We thought the Marines were going to come back and really wipe us out. And they came back and hey, that's great. When you've been on an island for 6 months, pink underwear.
Get a little variety.
Yeah.
You know, there's a famous football coach at Iowa who painted the visitors' locker room pink because he thought it might take a little of their fire and masculine enthusiasm away. I guess they didn't do that to the Marines. That's good to know. Tell you what, I know there are some more hijinks that you want to share, and you also brought a souvenir with you. It's about 6 inches long, a little rusty now, 65 years later, and it's a big hunk of metal. We're going to get the explanation behind that. Jim Robinson of Selma, our guest today. You're listening to Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Veterans everywhere recognize that as Anchors Away, performed there by the local Sounds of Freedom Band. I'll keep you posted when concerts are coming up for that great organization of local volunteers who range from age 15 to 90, believe it or not. In fact, we've had that 90-year-old on this program. We continue now with a bit of a younger man, Jim Robinson. He's not quite up there yet. He's just 86, right?
Correct.
All right. Well, you got a long time to go here, and we've got the rest of this hour to talk to you about some of your experiences and World War II in the Navy. We were talking about your time in the Solomon Islands on an island called Bonica, where all those coconuts were around. It wasn't just the coconuts that were falling, though. There were things falling from the sky, too. I guess you were on the flight path for some Japanese bombing runs?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, they would, when the full moon started coming, where they could see land from the sky, they would come over to bomb Guadalcanal, and they would... The main forces would hit Guadalcanal, and they would leave a few planes, nuisance planes, over our island to drop their bombs and to strafe. And then they'd pick up, when the main forces came back, that small group would rejoin them and go back where they came from.
How much warning would you guys get on something like that? Did you know they were coming?
No. You hear the engines.
Mm-hmm.
So when you hear the engines, somebody runs out and starts turning a hand crank that makes a siren that sounds throughout the whole area, and everybody heads for a dugout.
And then what did you have to do in those situations? Are you just ducking for cover? Are you checking guns?
If it were during the day, we'd man our guns.
Mm-hmm.
At nighttime, we didn't man our guns because we didn't want to give away position.
Sure, because they see the gun firing from the ground, and they know where you are.
The Army manned their guns, and they had to move them every day.
Mm.
After every raid, they had to relocate their guns.
So in a situation, daylight, they're coming over and bombing, you say you guys had to man your guns. Is that something that you had to do, or are you just checking to make sure they're working?
No, both. Uh-huh. I was responsible for the condition of guns, but also was gunner on many occasions.
So you had to know how to operate one of those. And what were you talking about, 50 calibers? What are we doing here?
20 millimeter.
20 millimeter.
Yes, uh-huh. They're about you big around.
Mm-hmm. I've seen them. Was that something that gave you a little adrenaline in that kind of moment?
It did.
Does it scare you a little bit at the same time?
Sure did.
You remember ever coming close to hitting anything?
Well, we got credit for a hit, but there were a couple of guns involved in it, so it never really pinpointed down and said it was your gun, but they said it could have been your gun. Yeah.
You guys weren't going to fight over.
They came low because when they flew high, they were too high for the 20 millimeters.
Mm-hmm.
But if they came low, we had a chance at them.
And you'd been trained in all of that?
Yes. And the guns were in a log cabin. Logs were stacked around with dirt packed up against them for a revetment, they called it, for protection for us. And we were down in that little tub.
What's the trick in a situation like that? It's not like you have a whole bunch of time to think about it and say, I think he's going to come over here. Are you trying to judge the altitude of the plane by some landmarks? What is the trick for trying to hit a plane who's flying in trying to kill you?
Well, we shot the magazines that the ammunition was in, were about every third round was a tracer.
Mm-hmm.
So we could see where we were shooting. And in a clear night, you could see the plane.
Mm-hmm.
So you were trying to, of course, hit them or shoot in front of them, let them fly into the flak.
But if you don't have the altitude right...
No.
You're going to be way up.
No, the Army would have to use their big guns to get the bombers that were up high.
Mm-hmm. And you were shooting at them, but they were also doing something to you. You had bombs dropped at you, strafing?
They would drop the bombs, and if we were in the shelters, when the first one dropped, you shuddered because you wanted to wait for that second one. Is it going that way, or is it coming toward you? So when the second one drops and it's further away, then you relaxed.
Now, you're talking about a matter of just a few seconds.
Right, yeah.
But I bet it didn't feel like just a few seconds.
No.
Just
right.
What is that feeling like? I imagine you... Are you closing your eyes? You're bracing for impact? What are you doing? You saying a prayer?
Yeah, we are. You're saying a prayer.
Uh-huh.
Yes, and a couple of times they were close enough to where they knocked dirt down into the hole that we were in. The word foxhole in that case was not appropriate because these were actually shelters. You could get eight men inside of one of them,
mm-hmm.
with coconut logs on top of them and dirt and so forth across that.
During all this time, did you see some of your friends pay the ultimate price?
No, I did not. We saw the only casualty we had actually on our island was two pilots, American Navy pilots, who came in together, and one of them got too low, and his propeller chopped the top of the cockpit of the one under him.
Mm.
And it was his best buddy. They always flew together, and that was quite dramatic.
There's so many of those horrible tragedies in war where friendly fire or avoidable situations like that claim the lives, but... those lives help pay for the freedom that we enjoy today. And speaking of paying for the freedom, you almost paid that price. You've got a souvenir here. I'd say that's, what, about 6 to 8 inches long?
Mm-hmm.
And you've had that since 1943.
Yes, that's what it's been, 43. Uh-huh.
And it's sitting on a piece of your old white uniform, which is a little yellowed now after 65 years. Why don't you read for me, if you can, Jim, what it says on that that old piece of fabric there with a...
That piece
don't
of
cut
fa-
yourself.
That piece of fabric was the white pants leg. We had to cut... They were too long, and we had to cut them off and sew them by ourselves because there was no sewing machines, of course. So this is part of a pants leg of a uniform. Bonica Island, South Pacific, 1943. This piece of shrapnel fell and stuck in the ground where I had just been standing. Moments before, I figured it had my name on it.
And you've kept
So I kept it all these years.
I want to ask you how you got it home and all those circumstances, but first let's talk about this, because that was a pretty matter-of-fact encapsulation of what happened, just what you were able to write down on that piece of fabric from your old white uniform pants. This is another bombing raid, so mm-hmm. you're up at your duty station, and you're on a gun, or...
No, I was in my tent.
Mm-hmm.
It was nighttime, and I was heading for the shelter.
Mm-hmm.
So I stepped outside, hesitated to see if I could see the plane, and then went on to my shelter, and I took my step toward the shelter that hit right behind me.
So this is outside the tent?
Yeah, just right at the entrance of the tent. Uh-huh, yeah.
Did you hear it coming?
No.
You just turned around?
I heard something hit.
Uh-huh.
I turned around and saw it, yeah.
And you said, you know what, I want to hang on to that. Was it a little hot when you picked it up?
Uh-huh, it was.
You didn't burn yourself, did you?
No.
And you, it occurred to you right then that you should hang on to this as a souvenir?
Yeah, I thought, well, I wonder if that's Japanese or I wonder if that's American, because it could have been one of our shells that we shot up at the planes, but it didn't matter. It missed.
Amen to that. Have you ever thought about how that could have been different, close you came?
That's right. You know, you don't know it. Probably wouldn't have been fatal, but it certainly would have done damage, because it was... coming down this way, not flat,
mm-hmm.
and stuck in the ground.
Well, and it's a pretty jagged piece of metal that would have come down with a lot of force and a little bit of weight to it, and certainly wouldn't have made you feel good if it didn't kill you. How do you account for your life being spared that way and for surviving such a close call?
I think I had divine guidance on that.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that's something where you say, if I had waited another split second to get out of my tent...
Who pushed me that step?
I guess that's reason enough never to procrastinate,
that's
huh?
That's right.
So how did you get that home? Because this is 1943. There was still another 2 years of the war.
Yeah, I just carried, you know, it's small, and I just carried it with me.
Had it in your pack.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Kept in my locker aboard ship, and then when I came back and was stationed in Jacksonville, Florida, I took it with me and eventually brought it home.
And I imagine now you're thankful that you did.
Yes.
What do you find yourself reminded of when you're around the house and your eye just catches that piece of shrapnel?
Well, I think I'm lucky. As a 20-year-old young man, a lot of life ahead of you, mm-hmm. and I'm glad I was able to enjoy it.
How many children and grandchildren wouldn't be here if that had hit you on the head?
Yeah, well, Ken's the oldest of the four children, mm-hmm. and they've produced 10 grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a group that wouldn't be here.
They're all pretty thankful that missed. And if they ever complain, you can show that to them and say, hey, you wouldn't be here if this didn't miss me. And you mentioned Ken. I think a lot of our listeners might know Ken Robinson, who writes for the Fresno Bee and has done a great job there for so long and has that column on Sundays that we all enjoy, the local scene. I want to talk to you more about any souvenirs you might have brought home from the war and the rest of the war. We're still in 1943. We've got a ways to go here. And I want to get your feelings on Dugout Doug, General Douglas MacArthur, too, before we wrap up this show. We're going to take another commercial break here. We'll come back with more with Navy veteran of World War II, Jim Robinson of Selma, today. You're listening to Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Man from all Chicago way. He had a boogie style that no one else could play. He was the top man at his craft. But then his number came up and he was gone with the draft. He's in the army now, a blowing reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. They made him blow a bugle for his Uncle Sam. It really brought him down because he couldn't jam. The captain seemed to understand.
The Andrews Sisters, boogie woogie bugle boy. Does that sound like it did 60 years ago, Jim?
Same thing.
You used to listen to that a little bit, huh?
Oh, yeah.
And I imagine you didn't get a huge variety of music out on Bonica Island in the Solomons.
We got good music from Tokyo Rose.
Oh, yeah?
If you've ever heard that name or not.
Of course, sure.
And she would play all the latest songs and all those songs for us and try to demoralize the troops by saying that the people back home are having fun while you're out here. Why don't you give up and drop your guns and surrender? And
you weren't falling for that.
No.
It was
entertainment for us.
I've talked to a lot of guys, either in the Navy or who were flying in the Air Corps, mm-hmm. who had their squadrons or their planes announced by Tokyo Rose, or they heard the name of their ship said by Tokyo Rose. Did you ever have an experience like that?
They never named our ship that I heard, but the Marines fooled them one time. They had a plane with four guns, two guns in each wing, with black circles around the barrel, and they painted two more black circles. And Tokyo Rose says, we know that the Marines have this new planes with six guns. So they were pretty sharp on observation.
That reminds me of a story I need to share one of these weeks on the program that one of our listeners sent me about a situation in Europe where two B-24s, actually, two B-17s collided top to bottom and got stuck together like a pair of building blocks. And some Germans on the ground thought it was a new eight-engine, double-winged bomber. So that was interesting. And I will share that story one of these weeks on the program. It's a very fascinating and inspiring story of the camaraderie that exists and the dedication that members of the military have to each other. Jim Robinson served in the Navy in World War II. He's been our guest today, and we'll finish out the program hearing about his experiences. And I want to ask you about a guy who, I guess to some extent, has been a polarizing figure in history. Some people loved him. Some didn't like him so much. And that included the President of the United States at one point. I'm talking about General Douglas MacArthur. And I guess in your circles, the name Dugout Doug probably resonated quite a bit.
It did.
Tell us about what impact he had on your life and the lives of the guys you served with.
Well, as far as the Navy is concerned in the Pacific, Admiral Bull Halsey was in charge of the fleet. And he was very much in favor of looking out for the enlisted man.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a program where at 16 months, your name would go in for rotation back to the United States, and at 18 months, you were on your way. Douglas MacArthur took over as Supreme Commander of the Pacific and said, that's a lot of poppycock. I've been out here for 2.5 years. There's no reason the Navy should go back in 18 months. What he neglected to say is his wife and family were on Australia. So he was not very well liked by the
He was a little Navy. Resented.
Yes.
And we'll hear more about General MacArthur from other veterans over the course of this program, I'm sure. And I know a few people. In fact, you have a neighbor there in Selma who was there when General MacArthur waded back ashore at Leyte. A lot of guys have different interactions with some of these famous names in history. Any other kind of brushes with fame that you remember? Were you ever entertained by any good people in your time in the Navy?
No.
Weren't so fortunate. Panika wasn't on the tour stop, I guess.
Well, it was, but I had been transferred off the island when Bob Hope's troop came.
You just missed them.
A month after I left, they came to Bonica. No one knew where Bonica was until Bob Hope came there, and that kind of put it on the map.
Well, I suppose it would. Yeah. And what a friend to veterans Bob Hope was.
Oh, Joey Brown came.
Uh-huh.
And we were sitting on logs and watching. We had a little stage up there, and it started raining. Real big drops of rain, just splattering down.
Which you were probably used to by then.
Well, yes, but we don't usually sit in it. We take shelter. And Joey Brown looked out and said, if you tailors are dumb enough to sit in the rain, I'm dumb enough to continue the program. So he went on.
Wow, I guess it was worth it, huh?
Yes.
Now, after 11 months on that wonderful coconut clustered island, you were asked to board the USS Wright.
Yeah.
What kind of ship was that, and what kind of things did you do there?
That was a seaplane tender, and their job was to maintain a crew, keep the crew, and maintain planes for the flying boats, the PBYs.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a black cat squadron that flew at night and did observation, and they also had some that did some bombing, and we kept the bombs and the ammunition and housed the pilots, and they had a mechanical group that took care of the planes. We would take care of the planes until the Seabees could build a shore base to take care of them on shore. Then we'd go to another island and take care of them, so we kind of island hopped and stayed a month here and a month there and 3 weeks here, and that was our job.
Saw a good portion of the Pacific that way, I imagine.
That's right. Saw a lot of islands. They all look alike.
You probably also saw a lot more Japanese aircraft overhead.
We did.
Any other, we talked about the shrapnel that almost got you. Any other close calls or things that you witnessed in your time on the right that kind of stands out in your memory?
No, not from the enemy, but from our own carelessness. We were manning my buddy and I were gunner's mates, and we were taking care of the 1.1, which was an English pom-pom gun with four barrels, like the 40 millimeter.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a plunger on the nose, so when they hit, they exploded, and we're greasing them so they won't rust the nose of them. And one slipped out of his hands and hit the deck, and the pin went clear up inside of it. Nothing happened.
Holy cow.
So I did the hatchways, and he took it and threw over the side, and that was it. But we were both kind of white and shaky for a while.
Well, that's right up there with your piece of shrapnel. I think that's a closer call. That would have blown you to smithereens.
Oh, yes, because we're in a place that's nothing but ammunition.
Uh-huh.
Stored, yeah.
Would have set off a chain reaction and...
Would have.
Holy cow. I guess if there was ever going to be a dud, that was the one to pick.
Our gunnery officer never knew of that.
You weren't eager to tell him, huh?
No.
And I guess that's another case where you might look back and say, somebody was looking
that's
out
right.
for me.
That's right.
How often were you called upon to do things like that, to clean guns? Did you ever have guns that were not working and they really
yes,
gave you a hard time trying to fix them?
We had you have, in the Navy, you have, when you fire a gun and it does not fire, you have a hang fire or a misfire. A hang fire does not work right away, but it goes off a few seconds later or a minute later.
Mm-hmm.
A misfire never fires. So on the 2-inch gun, we had the hang fire, and the gunnery officer and myself cleared everybody else off the deck, and we had to back that shell out of the gun, not knowing whether it's going to go off, whether it was a hang fire or misfire.
That sounds like Russian roulette to me.
So we trained a barrel in on deck, and I took a great big rod and backed it out. He took it in his arms and carried it over and dropped it over the side.
Wow. I wouldn't sign up for that job. That doesn't sound like a whole lot of fun.
They didn't explain that to me when I took the job.
Yeah. You might have to carry things that may or may not blow you up. So How long did you spend on the right now?
About 11 months.
Another 11 months. And was your ship ever targeted by the Japanese?
No.
And you wanted to keep it that way?
Fortunately. It was a floating ammunition carrier and high-octane gasoline for the planes. So the last thing we wanted to do was get a hit.
How did you avoid that? Just didn't make yourself a target?
Blacked out and sit and watch. The guns were manned. As the Japanese planes were coming, we were on following the planes,
mm-hmm.
but not firing.
Those were your orders, not to fire.
Yeah.
Was there ever a time where you felt that was unfortunate, that you weren't allowed to fire?
Yes, because one time in the New Guinea area, a concrete tanker was tied up over closer to shore, and the Japanese saw it, and they bombed it, two planes, and we could have prevented that because we were following the planes with our guns. But because of our orders not to fire unless fired upon, we just stood by and watched.
Well, and I guess you could look back and say you very well could have saved that ship, but in the process might have gotten your own ship blown up.
Sure.
So it might not have been a fair trade necessarily. No. Now, I know we have lots more to talk about here, and I want to ask you, though, before we get into a couple more lighthearted stories from your time in the service, where were you when the war ended? Where were you on VJ Day, and how'd you hear about that?
Jacksonville, Florida.
You were already home?
No. In the Navy. Uh-huh. Jacksonville Naval Air Station.
Mm-hmm.
I was what they call a general service rate as a gunner's mate, but because I had been on a seaplane tender, which was Naval Air,
mm-hmm.
they attached me to Naval Air. So I was in the Jacksonville Naval Air Station.
So you'd earned enough points to come back home?
Yes, yeah.
I guess so, if you'd been in since 1942.
They gave you, on discharge, they gave you a point for every month you served and an extra point for every month you served overseas, so.
Now, were you thinking, and you're back in Jacksonville, were you thinking there was a chance you were going to have to go back?
Not in Jacksonville, but when I first came back and got married in San Francisco, I was available for immediate reassignment overseas.
Well, it seems to me like that might be a moment that I might want to listen to you talk about. You got back to San Francisco and got married. You had had a sweetheart waiting for you?
We were engaged since 1942, and in long engagement due to, mm-hmm. thanks to Uncle Sam.
Wrote letters back and forth?
Yes. Oh, that's where the hats come in.
All right. I'll tell you what, that sounds like a good story to pick up after this final commercial break. That's where the hats come in. We're going to hear the story about the hats. And you might be surprised to know that his military service was not over at the end of World War II. Much more to come with Jim Robison today. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Our guest today, Jim Robison, is a Navy veteran, but in 11 months as a seaplane tender on the USS Wright, he encountered plenty of pilots who had experiences like that. And I understand that hearing that song by the Song Spinners, Coming In on a Wing and a Prayer, brings you right back to something that you witnessed in your time in the Navy.
Yes. I was visiting a friend from Los Angeles who was stationed on Guadalcanal. I had a 72-hour leave, and the Japanese attacked at that time. And our forces were out attacking the Japanese. So after the Japanese left the island, here comes this lone plane flying in and would not answer the IFF, the identification code that they're supposed to answer. And the reason was that they had been shot out and they had no way of answering. So the Marines on the island, the Florida Islands, which is across the bay from Guadalcanal, fired on this plane. Mm-hmm. It was one of our own.
Right, but they didn't know that.
No, they did not know that, and they could not let them know. I mean, there's no way that the plane could let the ground know until they got down so close it could be identified. But by that time, they were coming in on three engines. They had a four-engine plane. The Japanese had shot out one engine, and the Marines shot out the second engine. So when they landed on two. So that was I thought was quite appropriate for that song, because it actually happened.
They did come in on a wing and a prayer. I'm sure they were praying the Marines didn't shoot them all the way down. They had two engines left. Now, before we took that final commercial break, you said that's where the hats came in, and you were talking about your romance, engaged from 1942, and she's back in Southern California waiting for you all this time while you're in the South Pacific. You said that's where the hats come in. Explain that to me.
Well, we were engaged during that period. I gave her engagement ring before we left. She wrote every day but three of the 2 years I was gone.
That's some hand cramps. That's a lot of writing.
And the mail orderly and all those guys were always after me. Said, "Well, Robinson, every other name they call out is yours. You get all the mail. So you go get the mail yourself." So I had to admit. So one time I came back to my workstation, and here were all of my letters stapled on the bulletin board, maybe 15 or 20 letters. And so I thought, well, I have to retaliate some way. So the next day when we came to work, they all put their white hats down. They didn't wear them when they were working. And I took and stapled all their white hats to the bulletin board. There was about 15 or 20 white hats. They don't know whose is whose, and they got to unstaple them and check the name on them and so forth. They had a pretty good hunch who had done it.
But I imagine they didn't staple any more of your letters to the bulletin board.
No, they didn't staple any more of my letters.
You got a message through to them. Now, were you writing back all this time? And if so...
Not that often.
And if so, your letters probably got censored a little bit.
They did. Oftentimes, pieces cut out on them. They cut them out instead of having a black marker like you would today.
Mm-hmm.
But they would just cut out the section that they didn't want in there.
Loose lips sink ships, and they didn't want any of that information
That's
getting
right.
anywhere. So, describe for me what it was like when you got back to San Francisco and you got to see her again. Was it one of those situations where you didn't believe it till it actually happened?
That's right. We had a little mix-up there, too, because she was coming into the Oakland train station. And mm-hmm. I was in San Francisco, so I got across to Oakland to wait for the train station. The train came in. The passengers came off. Everybody's off the plane. No Thelma. That was her name, was Thelma. So what in the world happened? She's not on the train.
And she's written you letters for 2 years, but
yeah,
she doesn't show up. What's the deal?
So there was a couple, an older couple, a man and his wife standing there, and they were waiting for someone. And so they went and inquired and found out that there are two train stations in Oakland. And she had come in the other one. So she comes in the train station and says, "Where is he? He's not here." So this couple took me in their car and drove over, and it all ended well. She was standing at the train, and their son was standing at the train station waiting for him.
So without that couple, you would have been in some pretty big trouble, too.
I would. I'm not sure I had enough money for a cab.
Did she give you a lecture when you finally showed up? What was
no,
that moment like?
We realized what had happened.
And how many hours passed until you got married?
Next day, I think.
Uh-huh.
The family wanted us to get married down south. My father-in-law had a new suit, and she had a wedding dress, and everything was fine. The church was all arranged for. But when my order said, after 30 days leave, I was available for immediate overseas duty. We said, well, hey, why waste a couple of weeks before I get to Los Angeles?
So she was tired of waiting. Whether you were going back or not, she was going to marry you.
So we got married in San Francisco, just the two of us,
mm-hmm.
and then went home for a reception instead of a wedding. And then I was stationed in Jacksonville, Florida, but I had no way of knowing that.
And it was in Jacksonville that you got the news? The war is over.
Yes, yes.
Was there a big celebration in Jacksonville
that
day?
Yeah, like a parade.
And, of course, there's a famous picture that's been the subject of a lot of debate in New York City on VJ Day.
Where the guy's kissing the girl. And
the sailor's kissing the girl. Yeah. I imagine you snuck in a kiss that day.
Well, yeah, I got one or two.
But after the war, so you're out of the service, but you signed back up for the Navy Reserve?
Yes, I was buying a house. And I didn't have enough money to pay the down payment and so forth. So I said, hey, it needs more income. So my buddy said, well, join the reserve. Make some extra money.
Mm-hmm.
So I did. And then suddenly the Korean deal broke, and they called me back to active duty.
And by now you probably had children.
Ken was 3 years old, and his brother Steve was just born. I saw him in the hospital as I left.
I imagine it was a little harder to leave that time than the first time. And how long were you deployed during the Korean War?
Year and a half.
Any more close calls you want to share?
No.
Thank the Lord.
By that time, I had changed my Navy rate from a gunner's mate to a storekeeper, which was supply.
Mm-hmm.
And so I worked in the supply area in the island of Guam in the Marianas.
Mm-hmm. So you got to see a little more of the Pacific since you didn't see it all the first time.
Yeah.
When you came back from that, and that's a long time. I mean, there are guys that were gone during World War II for 3-4 years and met children for the first time when they came back, perhaps. But when you came back and got to see your boys again, what did that feel like?
It was almost unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
I think the weeds in the backyard were as tall as Ken.
So you were put right to work when you got home.
Oh, I know there's a lot to look back on. Another lighthearted story that I wanted to get your take on. I understand that while you always had to be on the lookout for Japanese troops or planes or you know, an invasion when you're on Banica Island or wherever you were, there also were some other threats, some wildlife, some sharks became an issue at one point. Do I have that right? Did someone was asked to shoot at the sharks?
What it was as a gunner's mate, when the group went swimming on an island, we had two motor whale boats that patrolled on the ocean side of the swimmers because of sharks. And so we carried Thompson submachine guns because those projectiles would penetrate the water where the other bullets would bounce off. So it gets boring rowing back and forth and while these guys are out there swimming. So once in a while, we'd holler shark and fire our guns and watch everybody swim for sure.
So there weren't necessarily sharks.
No, never saw a shark.
You were just having a little fun at the expense of the guys in the water. I imagine they swam a little faster.
Real fast.
And no one was ever hurt, right?
No.
Okay, that's good to know.
We didn't fire toward them. We fired away.
Right. Just wake them up a little bit. Before I get your final thoughts on World War II in general and its significance in your mind, any other anecdotes or experiences that you want to share with our listeners today?
Yeah, aboard ship, because I had to go get the mail, act as mail orderly, you know, and kind of all those letters I got, I was able to bring back a big stock of bananas.
Mm-hmm.
And the bananas were on the island, but they're kind of a premium aboard ship. Put them down in the magazine area because the temperature is constant down there, and they would ripen, and that would be fine. So one day my buddy and I go down. We had keys to the magazine. We went down and got bananas. And while we're down there, we see these khaki pants coming down the ladder into this ammunition area. It was the captain of the ship.
Uh-oh.
He says, "Gunner's mate, I did not get permission to open." He had to get permission to open any of these because you don't know what's, if the Japanese in the area, you don't open magazines. And we said, "Oh, this is it. We're broken back down to apprentice seaman now or something." And he says, "What?" And I said, "Well, Mary, got a stock of bananas over in shore, and we were coming down and getting a couple of bananas." "Don't let that happen again, and I'll send my orderly down for some bananas," he said.
So what percentage of the bunch did ended up in the captain's quarters?
Well, a good bunch of them. But we were real relieved because that could have been very bad.
Mm-hmm. He let you off the hook. And he didn't slip on a banana peel on his way back up the steps. I bet that banana tasted pretty good when he finally bit into it.
Yeah.
Well, when you look back now, Jim, after 65 years since that shrapnel missed you by a couple inches and you think back on all of it, how would you characterize the significance of what you and guys like you did? Why were you doing it, and why should we keep it in mind still today?
Well, I don't think that most of us considered it heroic. It's likened unto a bad dog comes in the neighborhood with rabies, and you go get your club or your gun and go out and shoot it or something like that. It's just something you do to protect.
You did your duty.
Yeah. And you're no hero for doing it. That it's something that needs to be done. I think that's the attitude that most of the fellows that I know took it toward it. It's something that had to be done, and we're glad. We'd rather do it over there than have to protect our homeland on the homeland.
Amen to that. Well, I know that there are a lot of people who are thankful for your service to our country, for your willingness to go and preserve our freedom. And I know for a fact that there are at least 14 people who are glad that shrapnel missed you because they wouldn't be here otherwise. Thanks so much for your service to our country and for being here today.
Thank you for interviewing.
That's Jim Robison of Selma. Our guest today will be back next week with a Pearl Harbor edition of Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.